UK Wine Show, show number 43, Geology with Richard Selly. G'day, welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 43 for the 23rd of March. My name's Chris Scott, and this week we're going to be talking with geologist Richard Selly. Richard was the man who told Denbys, the UK's largest winery, where to build. But we're not going to talk to Richard about Denbys, we're going to be talking to him about rocks. The number of times that I've been to tastings, and the person presenting goes to great lengths to describe the soils that the grapes are grown on, but they never explain why the soils are so good. They just sort of describe the soils without really talking about why. And some soils are great in some climates, and some soils are better in other climates. Without really understanding that, it's pretty pointless. I've seen, you know, pretty famous people talk to people about the soils in great depth, and you know the audience has no idea what's going on about the soils. They just think that person must be very knowledgeable because he knows about the soils. And it drives me absolutely crazy. So this week, I thought we'd get geologist Richard Selly, who has more than a fleeting interest in the wine trade, to talk to us about rocks. We're going to be talking about the three main types of rocks and how they're formed, and also the key factors that influence growing grapes on the different types of rocks. But before we get into that, let's have the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. UK wine drinkers love Rioja, according to the latest figures. The UK shipped in 27.8 million litres of this Spanish wine last year. This was 13.8% more Rioja than in 2005, and in value terms represented a rise of over 22%. Bottle-wise, this is an astonishing leap compared to 6 years before, when less than 10 million litres was shipped to our shores. The reason Rioja is doing so well is because it has been reinventing itself, according to Sue Glasgow, spokesperson for the Rioja Information Centre. She told us winemakers are taking more interest in terroir and where they plant their grapes, and there's a rise in single vineyard and single varietal wines. Winemakers are also thinking about the styles that consumers want to drink. Younger wines are very fruit-driven, while older wines, such as Crianza, Reserva and Gran Reserva, have a sweet fruit flavour but are not overburdened with oak. Certainly this move is working. Currently the UK is by far the number one importer of Rioja in the world, taking 70% of the region's exports. And last year the wine's governing body launched the Rethink Rioja campaign to try to raise awareness. Meanwhile, the wine societies of Oxford and Cambridge universities are making a bid to have wine tasting declared an official sport. If they are successful, team members will get half blues if they represent their university and will be entitled to wear the official blazers. Half blues, as opposed to full blues, are generally awarded for sports that aren't very well represented. The varsities take wine tasting very seriously and train hard to prepare themselves for the annual competition. The Cambridge University Blind Wine Tasting Society selects their team approximately 1 month before the competition, and they then train 6 days a week until the match. At Oxford too, there's a busy training schedule. The Oxford University Wine Circle has one or two weekly sessions with an industry professional, such as an MW or a senior member. These sessions are given in tutorial fashion, analysing each wine in depth and discussing blind tasting rationale. The blues committees of both universities have been lobbied in the past, but the idea of ratifying wine tasting as a sport was rejected. However, both sides now think it would be a much more convincing and persuasive argument if they presented their case together. The contest dates back to 1953 and has been sponsored by Paul Roger Champagne since 1992. As with the boat race, there is much competitive rivalry between the teams. Cambridge won this year's match, which was held last month, but Oxford are ahead on wins overall. And finally, in the budget this week, Gordon Brown announced a bigger-than-usual increase on wine duty. Still wines will rise by 5p a bottle to £1.34, while sparkling wine has risen by 7p a bottle to an eye-watering £1.72, and typically has raised duty on still wines by only 4p a bottle. And finally, 50 years ago, the Armstrong Cork Company claimed in its advertising that corks didn't contaminate the contents of wine bottles. They said in the advert that for years bottlers had experimented with closures of all types, but they still came back to the centuries-old seal that was cork. That's all for the news this week. Back to you, Chris.
Thanks for that, Jane. Well, Mr. Brown has raised the price of duty quite a bit. 5p for still and 7p for sparkling wines. Both these are the biggest rise that he's put through in the last 10 years. In fact, Gordon has put duty up by 33p a bottle for still wines and 22p a bottle for sparkling wines. He does say this is to match inflation, but the average price of a bottle of wine has been pretty flat over the last 10 years, so it's not inflation in the wine industry that he's doing it, it must be the general economic inflation. Given that the price of wine stayed fairly flat over the last 10 years, he's taking more and more and more of a slice of the pie on that bottle of wine. It'll be interesting to see how the High Street responds. A couple of years ago, Sainsbury's added 4p to the bottle of wine, and that went straight on the reselling price. So a £4.99 quid bottle of wine went up to £5.03. It only lasted a couple of weeks, but it was pretty interesting. Last year, a lot of the big multiples, like the supermarkets and the big wine chains, told their suppliers that they were not going to wear the duty increase and that it had to be worn by the suppliers. That isn't really what happens. The suppliers, and particularly the winemakers, removed the value of duty from the value of the wine. So don't expect the bottle of wine to taste the same, particularly if it's made by a large manufacturer who have the resources just to blend the wine slightly differently and get a slightly cheaper blend. The escalation in cost without a change in price mean that quality must drop. After all, huge multinational companies do not wear a drop in revenue, so if they can't increase the price due to competition, they simply drop the quality. Next up, we got the interview with Richard Selly, geologist. The interview is a wee bit technical in places, and I've put some show notes up. So if you want to go to the ukwineshow.co.uk and click on show number 43, so there's some notes up there about the rocks that we're going to be looking at. Hi, I'm here with Professor Richard Selly. He's the Senior Research Fellow at the Department of Earth Sciences at Imperial College. How are you, Richard?
I'm very well, thank you. Ready to go.
Excellent, excellent. What we're going to be talking about today is geology, and particularly geology that relates to the UK and wine. You've written a book called The Winelands of Britain, Past, Present and Perspective, out a couple of years ago.
That's right.
And that would make you probably one of the most eminent geologists in the UK about wine.
How very kind of you to say so. Probably, yes.
Probably.
Yeah. It's a very small field.
I'm pleased we found you anyway. What we're going to be talking about is we're going to start off with the different soil types, or a couple of the different soil types, and maybe just talk a wee bit about how those relate to wine. A lot of people talk about terroir in a big way and talk about all sorts of things. But in your view, what do you think is the most important?
Well, I think if you look at the distribution of vineyards on different rock types, you can see that vineyards flourish on rocks of every age and of every type. But what is crucial is the interplay of geology and climate. It's that interplay that determines the soil in which the vines are planted and the landscape in which it grows.
Is it an interplay with the weather, or is an interplay with how the rocks is formed or the soil is formed?
Well, it's a bit of both. The soil is controlled partly by the modern weather, but also by past climate. For instance, in the British Isles, a lot of the soils that we grow vines on now are actually formed during the Ice Age in periglacial, near glacial conditions. So it's both modern and past climatic regimes that control the soil, together with, of course, the rock type beneath and adjacent to it. Rocks break down slowly with weathering, and that detritus then begins to slide down the hillsides. It's eroded, transported, and deposited as alluvial valley fill, as moraine debris on the edges of ice sheets, and so on.
The detritus, just so I've never really come across the word until I started reading your book. That's just the weathering.
Detritus is just rotten rock, posh word for rotten rock.
Okay, and does that form, that forms the soils in a lot of areas?
That's right. But soil, of course, will also contain a large organic component as well as just the inorganic mineral material.
Okay, so the rocks give you the mineral material, and then you've got the organic material like dead roots and leaves and all that sort of stuff broken
exactly into
it.
Exactly.
And that's what creates good soil and bad soil.
Exactly.
As a geologist, do you get excited by soils, or you're a rock man?
As a geologist, I try to scrabble my way through the soils as quickly as possible to get at the fresh stuff underneath, yes.
The rocks, the millions-a-year-old fresh
That's
stuff.
That's right.
Rather than the more recent thousand-year-old
Absolutely.
Soil.
Yeah.
Okay. When you've been looking around at different rock types and that you've seen vines growing in them, what are the key elements, do you think, for rocks and vines?
Well, as I say, you can actually grow vines very comfortably on everything from granite to sand to limestone to clay. But there are certain rock types that have more going for them than others. To take the downside of clays are normally highly porous with microscopic pores. So, of course, clays can get waterlogged. Now, depending on your climate and the relief, vines like a little bit of moisture, but they don't like to have their roots waterlogged. So clays, certainly in England, are not a good rock type on which to plant a vineyard. By contrast, if you take rocks like limestones are normally very hard, very brittle rocks, and so they fracture extensively, and vines can get their root systems going way down through the fractures to reach the moisture. There is a particular type of limestone that's very good for growing vines, and that, of course, is chalk. And chalk is the limestone on which champagne is grown in France, and some of the finest English wines are grown on, like vineyards at Denbigh's, planted on the recommendation of a notorious local geologist.
That would be you.
Yes, actually. my cover is blown already. Now, the magic of chalk is that it's fractured, so it's always well drained so long as it's above the water table. But chalk is chalky. It's very light compared to most limestones, and that's because it's got a microporosity. Chalk is about 30 or 40% holes. Okay. And the beauty of that is that in a hot, dry summer, the vines would not, of course, have been waterlogged, but they can suck moisture out of the microporosity between the fracture systems, and they will have roots going right the way down along the fractures, down as deep as they can to get to the water table.
So porosity is the gap, is the holes in the chalk?
That's right. Porosity refers to the storage capacity, and we normally measure that as a percentage. And most sedimentary rocks, like sands, would have about 20% porosity. Many limestones, it's much lower. Chalk is higher, with about 40% porosity. And then the other important parameter is permeability, which, as one of my students wrote in an exam, is the ability of a rock to pass water. It's the transmissibility, the connectedness of pores.
Okay, so porosity and permeability make up, high porosity and high permeability are good for wet areas.
Yes, that's true, yes.
Okay, and chalk has both got high porosity and high permeability.
That's right, yes indeed.
Okay, phew, it's taken me a while to get my head around that. And clay's
highly porous, but lacks permeability. It's what we often call an aquaclude because it inhibits water flowing through it. But, of course, as clays compact, they change into a rock that we call shale, and shale is brittle, and shale, of course, will therefore often fracture. And to that extent, it's having petrophysical properties. That's the learned term for the relationship between porosity and permeability. Shales have petrophysical properties that are rather similar to those of chalk. In other words, they're fractured, but they have some microporosity between the fracture systems.
We talked about chalk and clay, but there's you said in your book you mentioned three types of rocks.
Yes, indeed. We divide rocks into three genetic groups, named according to how they formed. And the first of these is the igneous rocks. And these form from molten material, magma, from deep beneath the surface of the earth. And if that magma cools very slowly, we get coarsely crystalline rocks like granite and gabbro. If the magma erupts at the surface as a volcano, we get volcanic lavas with lovely names like rhyolite and basalt.
Oh, I've heard of basalt.
All right. And then the second group of rocks are the sedimentary rocks.
Oh, just before we move on to that, Richard, I'd like to the soils for, you talk about basalt and the granite, in terms of for wine and their porosity and permeability, what's the story there?
Well, granites generally have very low porosity. They're often fractured. And if you look at granite outcrops, classic examples, of course, are down in Devon on Dartmoor. You'll see the granites are fractured. But normally you do need a little bit more porosity and permeability in granite. And that's why in some areas like Portugal, they actually used explosives to blast holes in the granite to provide places for the root balls of the vines.
Oh, okay. And but once the vines are in place, they can drive through?
That's right. They'll go down through the fracture system down to the water table to draw up moisture. You can see the same sort of thing in South Africa, in the Cape Province, where the Paarl area is a granitic terrain.
It's called igneous rock.
Are igneous rocks, yes. Yeah, and then the second group are the sediments. And these form where rocks of whatever sort are weathered by wind and rain. The detritus is eroded by rivers and wind and ice, carried down and deposited in rivers, in lakes, and in the sea. Mm-hmm. And the deposits are mud, which ends up as clay, sand, which ends up as sandstone, and lime, which is largely organic skeletal shelly material, which as it's buried turns into limestone.
So limestone is basically the dead shells for
That's
fish,
right, dead animals, dead plants, the calcareous skeletons of those, yes.
And everything else like sand and clay is the sediment from...
Sand, the original mineral grains that have survived weathering in igneous rocks.
Okay. And sand, again, high porosity?
High porosity. Sometimes, of course, sands, as they're cemented into sandstone, end up as very hard, tight, splintery rocks. Okay. Really what we call quartzite. Okay. But there are vineyards on quartzite as well, if they're fractured.
And the third type of rock was?
The metamorphic rocks, which literally mean changed. As our sedimentary rocks are buried by earth processes and hardened by heat and pressure, they often undergo changes and they form a completely new group of rocks. We call them metamorphic rocks, and they have lovely names like schist, say it carefully, and gneiss with a silent G. And some metamorphic rocks occur where you have igneous, you're getting familiar with that word now, igneous magma intruded into sediments, and you'll get a halo or aureole around that intrusion boundary.
Well, I'm a bit confused now.
Okay, if you've got magma coming up towards the surface, it's going to cook up the country rock as it passes through it.
Yeah.
And so you will get a halo around the magma.
Oh, okay.
So a very high temperature.
So you've got some sediment and it just starts to melt as
it
a magma.
It cooks up around there, yes.
Okay. And does that form, that's how glass is made, isn't it?
You'll get some glassy rocks like that, yes, indeed. Most glassy rocks are actually lava that has cooled very quickly.
Oh, okay.
And they have a lovely name. That's obsidian and tachylite. Great thing about geology is learning the buzzwords.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so they're the main types of rocks, and the type of things when you're looking at rocks from a vineyard point of view, you can talk about maybe...
Well, more or less, you shouldn't agonize about whether a particular rock is igneous, metamorphic, or sedimentary. You should focus your attention on its porosity and permeability.
So how much water it holds and how much it...
That's right, exactly, and also on the landscape that it's generating, whether... In England, for instance, we're concerned about south-facing slopes, frost hollows, dry valleys, and things like that. And we're also then very concerned about the soil that overlies the rock, whether it's just locally weathered soil or whether it's alluvium, river deposits that have been carried down, glacial deposits or deposits on the edges of ice sheets.
A lot of people, particularly in New Zealand, a lot of the good vineyards are grown on old riverbeds, the alluvial soils you talked about. Why is that?
Well, there are two reasons for that. You'll find the same thing in England. In the Thames Valley in particular, a lot of the vineyards are on old alluvial deposits, old river deposits. But that's not the modern floodplain. A modern river floodplain, because it floods, is great for water meadows. The cattle love it, but it'll rot the vine roots.
Yeah.
What we find, and probably the same in New Zealand, are raised river terraces on the valley sides.
Yeah.
And if you go down any river valley in the British Isles, you will see these river terraces. And that's where you've got nice flat gravel and sand, which is well drained, and it's above the water table. So the vines enjoy that. They can put their tap roots down to the water table several metres below. But the raised river terrace will always be well drained.
Okay, and so the alluvial, it's about allowing the water to drain through the soils.
That's it.
Are they quite loose as opposed to maybe some more compacted rock?
That's right, because they're quite young. They haven't been deeply buried.
All right then, Richard, I think we'll wrap it up there.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Richard. I suppose the two key words are porosity, the number of pores, and hence the amount of water that a rock can store, and the permeability, or the ability to pass water through the rocks, as Richard said, which is very important in a place like England, where you've got a lot of rain, so you need to be able to get rid of that and stop the roots of the vine getting wet. Don't forget to look on the show notes at ukwineshow.co.uk, show number 43, and they will reinforce some of the information you've learnt in this one. Next week, we're going to continue looking at rocks and vines with Richard. So until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show was brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show was produced by Jane Scott and recorded and edited by Chris Scott. The news was read by Jane Scott and researched by Sandra Clement. The music for the UK Wine Show is Griff to Jingle One by Marcel de la Jatelle and Silence by Etoile Noire.